Man, we have spent the last hour talking about the powerful people in the world. Putin, Trump, President of China, even Assad, the North Korean dictator. The most powerful person in the world perhaps doesn't even believe it. The most powerful person that I know is you. If you set your mind to it and you believe that you can truly make a difference, if all of us do that, the world changes. I'm going to introduce you next to a guy who believes he can change the world by convincing you you can change the world. We go there right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Leon Logothetis. He is a he's a man who is running a documentary called The Kindness The Kindness Diaries on Netflix. You can see it, and he's traveling the world on a mission of kindness. I'll let him explain it, but I'm first. I want to just find out who you are. What's your background? Where are you from?
Sure. So I used to be a broker in the city of London. On the outside, I had everything. And on the inside, I had nothing. Emotionally, spiritually bankrupt. And I happened across the movie The Motorcycle Diaries, which is a romanticized version of Che Guevara traveling around South America, giving back to people.
Okay, hang on just a second. When you say a romanticized version of Che Guevara, what do you mean by that?
It wasn't the real image of Che the murderer. It was the nice version of Che giving back.
So I just wanted to make sure you knew who Che Guevara was.
Absolutely.
Yes, okay.
And there was something about that movie that inspired me because he was giving back in a profound way. And I decided that I was going to quit my job and start traveling the world relying on kindness.
So Che has done something good then. As we see, at least he inspired you. If that's if nothing else.
Exactly, yeah. In the movie. That's why I always preface it by saying the romanticized version.
Right. Yeah, it's really interesting you say it because you walked in the studios and you said, "I love your artwork of Winston Churchill," and we just had a quick conversation with Winston Churchill, who you adore, perhaps even more than I do, and I think Winston Churchill is one of the greatest men to ever live. And so for you to say Che Guevara changed my life is kind of like, whoa, how does that fit?
Yeah. I mean, and some people say that to me. They're like, you know, Che wasn't a hero to many, obviously, but simply just the movie.
Yeah. Okay.
Have you watched the movie?
I have not, just because I know who Che is.
Yeah. And I quit my job and I started to travel the world relying on kindness.
What does that mean?
It means that I had no money. I had no food. I had no place to stay. All I had was my vintage yellow motorbike called Kindness One, sort of like Air Force One, but a little bit yellower. And I would give back to unsuspecting Good Samaritans life-changing gifts based on being helped by them. And they had no idea what was going on. And it was really just relying on kindness.
So it's kind of like the New Testament, don't worry about tomorrow. Don't worry about where you're going, where you're going to sleep, what you're going to eat. Just go and do good.
That was the aim.
Okay. And what do you mean, first of all, how are they kind to you? By giving you a place to sleep? By what?
Yeah, primarily it was human interaction, human connection. So if I felt connected to someone and they felt connected to me, they would maybe give me some gas. They would maybe put me up in their house. They would maybe give me some food. And then I'd go from them to the next person. For example, I met a homeless chap in Pittsburgh who, you know, had nothing really except one bag. Yet he offered for me to sleep on the streets with him. He offered to protect me. He offered to feed me. He offered to give me some clothes. And that was an act of kindness based on, you know, he didn't know what was going to happen. But I was fortunate enough to be able to put him up in a house and send him back to school. But really, it was that he taught me a really powerful lesson, that true wealth is not in our wallets, but it's in our hearts. Does that mean that money's not important? Of course not. Money is very important. But the truest of wealth comes from in here.
So how do you mean you were lucky enough to be able to send him back to school and put him up in a house?
Sure. So I've had many opportunities. You know, I worked in the City of London. I had financial security. So when I mean lucky enough is that I had the means to give back to him. I had the means to give him an opportunity.
So when you say you had no money, you didn't literally have
no
money.
You were just pretending.
Exactly. So I was doing a social experiment. Mm-hmm. In my everyday life, of course, I have money. But in that moment, for those 6 months, I had no money. Mm. And I was relying on kindness.
Did you take your like a credit card with you just in case?
No.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Really?
No,
you had no backup plan?
We were filming the Netflix show. So I had a crew. And the crew would stay.
And a catering truck.
A what?
And a catering truck.
Oh, man. Got some brie.
You were really
right?
homeless.
This
with
is
the
like
catering
the man,
truck.
Man versus wild, is it?
No, what's interesting is that the crew would film, and then they would leave. Mm-hmm. And there were. I have a book as well, and in the book, there's many moments that are not in the film because the crew weren't there. Mm. So, for example, that night with Tony, there was a moment where another homeless chap was having a little bit of a moment, let's say, but no one filmed that. Because no one was there except me and Tony and this other chap.
That's really interesting. So was there a moment where you were like looking at this and you're saying, you know, you have this crew there. Were the people suspicious of you?
Sure. Look, I think ultimately I would go up to people without the camera. Because if you just go up to someone with a camera, they're like, you know, please get out of my
face.
Yeah,
right.
So I'd explain what I was doing. And then if they were willing to help or if they were willing not to help, and they were willing to be on camera, I'd say, look, we have a camera crew. Are you okay to be filmed?
Uh-huh.
That's really how it would go.
Mm. So with this homeless guy, you bought him a house?
No, I put him up in a house.
Okay.
So he now lives in an apartment.
Really nice.
That's
wow.
That's great.
And he's gone back to school, and how's he doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a Hollywood ending.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, homelessness isn't just it's not just physical, it's also
mental.
A mental, exactly.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So he found himself in some trouble, but he's got back on his feet, he's back in a house, and I'm working to get him back into school. But it's not a Hollywood ending. I wish it was.
Yeah. I would imagine. That
those are very hard to find. We know, what's his name, Gardner?
Chris
Gardner from The Pursuit of Happiness.
Okay.
Know him quite well. And those endings are few
rare.
And far between.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at that and say, so you go through this process, and obviously the stories are kind of about changing other people. But I'd imagine that, like, there is a huge change that happened in you going through this process.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, so who is really helping who?
I think we're both helping each other. You know, that's the reality. I mean, when I did the journey, when you get such kindness, when you meet people who open their hearts up in such a beautiful way, you can't help but be changed. And I was definitely changed. I was changed by Tony.
How?
Because he had nothing. Yet he had everything. And it was like the opposite of me. Because on the outside, I had everything. On the inside, I had nothing. And this chap, on the inside, had everything. And the outside had nothing.
What do you mean by everything?
He came from his heart. He showed kindness. He was open-hearted. And I think many of us live up here.
Yeah.
I know that I did. And he taught me how to live down here. It wasn't just like that. It wasn't just like I met Tony and it all changed. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of the catalyst. It was another moment like, whoa, there's a chap that has nothing on the outside. And we're taught that you have to have everything on the outside. Don't get me wrong. Living on the streets is not fun. This guy was doing it for years. There are many people who do it for their whole lives.
Oh, you said it all when you said he would protect you.
Yes.
I mean, that to me, that's, you know, you... I'm sorry, but you know, I know you're British, but to say chap doesn't even, it dresses homelessness up too much for an American. Were you afraid when he, you know, when, because that is a part of being homeless. It's extraordinarily dangerous. Mental illness is a real problem with homelessness. Some people are homeless for a reason. They are social misfits, and they like being social misfits. The drugs, it's a dangerous world.
That's a great question. And I was told specifically on that night not to stay in this specific park. Yeah, prior to meeting Tony, I was walking the streets and I said, look, don't stay in this park past sundown. Yet when I met him, he said to me, you can stay with me. Every part of my body was like, do not stay on the streets of Pittsburgh. But there was this one little small voice that said, you have to stay with this man. And I followed that voice, and it was correct. Because like I said, he did protect me. And my intuition just guided me to that moment.
You a religious man at all?
I wouldn't say religious. I would say spiritual? I'm a man of faith, spiritual, yes. Okay.
So is that new for you?
It was, yes. It's not anymore, but it was. I believe you can't have experiences like that with Tony and not change and not...
Yeah. Not feel that you're connected somehow.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Did you spend nights without a place to live, a place to stay, and days without food?
Yes, not days without food. I would always find someone to give me some food, but there were times when
every day somebody gave you
yes.
food.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. It's truly amazing.
Just sometimes you didn't have a shelter.
Exactly, and I would sleep in the sidecar.
There was a study that came out this week that said that while the wealthy do give, the proportion is way out of whack. The poorer you are, the more likely you are to give big. You'll give half of what you have. Did you find a difference while you're on the street? What did you learn about giving?
Look, what I learned was that people who don't have a lot often have a sense of community that people who have a lot don't have. And when you have this sense of community, you just give. Like I was in India, and I ended up sleeping in the slums with this rickshaw driver and his family. Mm. And although on the outside, I would never want to sleep in the slums, I would never want to live in the slums, there was a sense of community in that place that was just second to none.
People don't have any idea when you say slums what Indian slums are like. That is poverty.
Raw sewage on the streets.
Right. We all obviously have our own struggles. You know, for example, the voice recognition in my car almost never recognizes what I said. but I would imagine going through this is something where like those types of problems are put in a completely different perspective for you now.
When you went back, were you a little grossed out by your former lifestyle?
I was grossed out by the way that I was living on the outside. I was grossed out by the fact that I had no, in those days, sense of connection. I was grossed out by the fact that I didn't have a sense of community, that I wasn't coming from my heart, that I wasn't being kind, that I was focused on one thing and that was just making money. There's nothing wrong with making money. But when you just make money and you don't come from your heart and you don't give back, that grossed me out.
You having a hard time holding it?
What do you mean?
You having a hard time going back into the world and holding tight to what you had when you were on the streets?
It's a great question, and sometimes yes, but I made a commitment to myself. And I said to myself that I was going to commit to this way of life, imperfectly, because no one's perfect, but I was going to do everything in my power to come from a place of kindness. I was going to do everything in my power to see another human being, because for many years I wasn't seen.
What happened to you that... I mean, you just don't wake up one morning and go, you know what, I want to give it all up. What happened to you? What?
So what happened to me was that on an emotional level, I was in deep pain. Many of us are in pain, yet we don't face it. And the pain was so great.
Do you mind explaining the pain? You don't have to.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, I was just very, very depressed and never felt seen in my home and also at school. I never felt like I was following my purpose. And it was just, it reached a point where it just broke. The dam broke. And leaving my job was the only thing I could do because the pain was just too much. And that's, had the pain not been that much, I wouldn't have done it.
No.
I would have still been there.
It bothers me that we live in a society now that wants to take away pain and suffering, and I don't mean this like, you know, we got to help suffering people, but we don't want anybody to fail. We don't want our kids to fail. We want to swoop in. There's always a drug for something. There's always a bailout for something. Every lesson of real importance that I've ever learned came from the bottom of my soul. You know, a place I didn't want to be. That's where I found out who I was. That's when I actually grew. When I'm just kind of drifting along and everything is okay and I'm just kind of even numb, there's no growth there. I don't connect with anyone. I don't reach outside of myself.
It's interesting. You're a Winston Churchill fan.
Yeah.
And Winston Churchill has a very famous quote, as I'm sure you know, which is, when you find yourself walking through hell, keep walking. And it, you know, pain is not pleasant.
No.
But if you find your way through it, there's a lot of light comes your way.
Mm-hmm. What do you have to tell us about, you know, here in America and in Europe too? Things are getting bad. Things are, you know it, over in the UK. There's trouble coming our way. And I am convinced the biggest trouble that we face is from us, not from the governments or anybody trying to kill us, but from us. We don't have a sense of community anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't trust each other. We don't trust our institutions. And, you know, de Tocqueville came from France and studied America and said in the 1800s, what made America great is America was good. And we've let institutions and governments do things for us, and we're losing our kindness. When you saw the streets of all over the world, and then you saw the streets of America, is there a difference in America, or is it the same? Are we more callous? Or are we kinder? Or are we like everybody else?
I think ultimately one of the greatest lessons I learned was that everyone simply, wherever you are, doesn't matter what religion you are, doesn't matter what color you are, simply just wants to be seen. And by being seen, I mean being loved, being heard, having a sense of community. And in the Western world, we come too much from our heads. We come too much from our iPhones. We come too much from being connected but not really being connected. And I would say just simplify things. I go and I speak at schools all the time, and I tell them, look, each and every one of you can change the world. And you can simply change the world by being kind to each other, by coming from your heart. It's such a simple thing. And being connected and just dropping down from the madness.
Leon Logothetis, he's got a new book out and Netflix documentary called The Kindness Diaries. It is a pleasure to meet you, sir. Thank you so much.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Man, I have so much respect for people like Leon and, you know, James Altucher. He's the, Jeff, you look him up. I can't think of a darn thing. I keep mixing him up with Malcolm Gladwell. We've had him on the show. He's a big investor.
Yeah, he looks very familiar.
Yeah,
we have. He's
angel
been here
investor.
In the building
He's a brilliant
times.
Man. Brilliant man. $14 million in the bank and everything else. And he decided, you know what? I am all about my stuff. And he sold and got rid of everything. His house, his car, his clothes. He put three outfits in a bag. He took his cell phone, his computer, put it in another bag. He lives now in Airbnbs. He doesn't own a car. He has no possessions. If it can't be carried in his bag, no possessions.
That's a big change.
We have to get him on because he is saying
that's interesting.
The things he's learning living a life with no possessions is pretty amazing. Our serial, last episode of Calvin Coolidge. You don't want to miss it. It's next.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
As one examines the life of America's 30th president, Calvin Coolidge, one thing becomes crystal clear. He is, without doubt, the most underrated, underappreciated president in U.S. history. After the Woodrow Wilson years had wrongly magnified the office of the presidency to near monarch-like status, Coolidge reversed all of that, as Amity Schlaes, author of the book Coolidge, explains.
he was walking along outside one day with a senator named Selden Spencer, and the senator was trying to jolly the often glum Coolidge up to cheer him up, and he said, "I wonder who lives in that pretty house with the white pillars over there." And Coolidge said, "Nobody. They just come and go."
Coolidge returned the constitutional balance of power. His hands-off or laissez-faire approach to government meddling in the economy, coupled with a slashing of the federal spending and cutting of taxes, led to virtually full employment and the most prosperous decade perhaps in the history of mankind, the Roaring Twenties.
It worked great. We had strong growth, 4% growth, the kind of growth that political candidates aspire to today. We had low unemployment, and the patent rate was through the roof. The patents of the 1920s are still studied, you know, in scholarly journals because inventors were so excited. And the reason for all this growth was the pullback of government, but also the assurance that government wasn't going to stop pulling back. People believed, well, this is the new way. There wasn't this great uncertainty of an erratic government. It turned out that that wasn't accurate. The government did expand again on a little bit under Hoover and a lot under Franklin Roosevelt, but there was a sense that the private sector was winning. Coolidge said, the chief business of the American people is business, the chief ideal of the American people is idealism, and he meant both.
He was a fierce advocate for civil rights for minorities, granting citizenship to Native Americans and fighting for equality for blacks. Critics on the left, they often point to the Immigration Act he signed into law in 1924, which dramatically choked off the flow of immigrants to America as proof that Coolidge was a racist. But that argument really falls apart pretty quickly, since the immigration at the time was coming from Europe, so it was almost exclusively white. With the U.S. population at the time of 99 million, taking in some 25 million new immigrants from 1871 to 1914 was massive and an overwhelming challenge. Coolidge and the Congress wanted to give the nation a chance to assimilate those that were already here. The most controversial element of the bill was a ban on Japanese citizens in the United States. David Petruzza, author of Calvin Coolidge, a documentary biography, explains the 30th president's problem.
Coolidge opposed this. His Secretary of State, Charles Evans Hughes, opposed this. And they went back and forth with Congress several times on that. But in fact, what happens is that there is a steamroller going through the Congress to restrict immigration and to restrict the Japanese. And he cannot do this. He cannot fight back against this. If he does veto the bill, what it will do is crash the entire immigration system, which was expiring by statute.
The fact was, Europe was a hotbed of trouble in nearly every country from which the immigrants were coming.
Remember, the backdrop is revolution in just about every country in Europe. So almost revolution in England, definitely revolution in Germany, certainly ominous revolution in Russia, and so on. Did we want a revolution here? No. And many of the immigrants here were quite interested in the revolutions over there, Sokol and Vanzetti. So Coolidge was restrictionist, as his party was, and he signed the Johnson Act, a quota-based immigration restriction.
Coolidge had a presidency of firsts. He was the first to light the national Christmas tree in 1923. He gave the first presidential radio address. And he was the first to broadcast his inaugural address nationwide. It's strange that he was the first voice to be heard because he was also a man of very few words. Once, when someone asked him why he spoke so infrequently, he said,
"If you don't say anything, you won't be called upon to repeat it."
One of the few missteps of Coolidge's presidency couldn't have been foreseen. Coolidge had one shot at appointing a Supreme Court justice during his time in office. To fill the role, he eagerly turned to his close friend and Attorney General Harlan Fiske Stone. Stone came with an excellent resume of conservatism, and Coolidge confidently nominated him to the court. Sadly, as this has happened many times since, within a year, Stone was siding with hardcore progressives. Court decisions and progressives like Louis Brandeis. Later, when conservatives like Chief Justice Hughes joined together to strike down several of FDR's New Deal laws, Stone was part of the progressive element of the heavily divided court. He became so reliable as a progressive that in 1941, FDR made him the Chief Justice. Fortunately, Coolidge didn't live long enough to see the decisions of those he had trusted tear down so much of what he had built. And what he had built was unprecedented. He had strictly adhered to the United States Constitution. He helped pull the nation out of a deep depression in just a year. He ushered in a kind of prosperity the country, in fact, the world, had never even before witnessed.
When I was writing the Coolidge book, I often asked myself, why aren't I writing the biography of the 20s, the roaring 20s, because they were real. Our kids, Great Gatsby notwithstanding, our kids read Great Gatsby and they think the 20s were a lie. On the contrary, they were admirable. That was the period when we got Saturday off because our productivity gains were so great. So think of it as the decade that gave you Saturday.
As the next election neared, the Republican Party was thrilled to have a wildly popular incumbent president to run again. The trouble was, the wildly popular president was still really despondent over the death of his beloved son. As the party bosses continued to hound him about running for a second term of his own, Coolidge traveled to South Dakota.
So the question was, would he run in 28? It would only be the second time. Why not? The Republican Party adored him. They said, this is our man. He was deeply popular, Coolidge. Of course he'll run again. How can you leave a sure thing? Of course he'll run again. But in the summer of 1927, Coolidge went to South Dakota for a vacation and also to conciliate. He wanted to placate the farmers whom he had not given a subsidy, whom he had denied a subsidy with vetoes. So there was sort of a political part to this summer trip as well. And there he was in South Dakota in Rapid City, making a summer White House in the high school. You can visit that. And living in a lodge out in the park.
It was there on that spot that the president made a decision, inspired by the carvings on Mount Rushmore.
What's going on in the park? The sculptor Gutzon Borglum is sculpting Mount Rushmore. And he wants, what does every artist want when he's working on something like that? An appropriation or a further appropriation for this enormous gargantuan project. So in Coolidge's mind, you have to think of the summer. He's trying to decide, 27, whether to run again. He's trying to decide about, you know, maybe visit this giant sculpture. Gutzon Borglum is just getting going. It's all together. And in August, Coolidge hands out a notice. I'm not going to run again. I do not choose to run again. The country is stunned.
Coolidge would later write in his autobiography that the biggest factor in not running was that the joy was sucked out of his life with the death of his son. But it really was the trip to Mount Rushmore that helped Coolidge decide against another term, as Amity Schles explains.
Coolidge goes up to Rushmore on a horsey to see how Gutzon Borglum is doing, maybe to hand some dynamite over. And you can see from the video that Coolidge is grossed out. And of course he would be, because what is Mount Rushmore? It's about superheroes. It's kind of Nietzschean, right? Big figures, T.R., Lincoln, Jefferson, and Washington. Oh, remember what the Coolidge might not like all that T.R. did for the Republican Party. And he looks at it, and you can see his ambivalence. You can see his disgust, and you can see how fast he turns away.
So Coolidge determined then and there in that summer of 1927, while in Rapid City, South Dakota, that he would walk away from the power of the presidency.
So there it is, exactly what he doesn't want to be, the exact reason he doesn't want to stay in office. And he writes in his autobiography, after a while, the president gets vain. The president is surrounded by yes men, and he starts to believe in his own grandeur. And he actually says in his autobiography, it's a great safety, I'm paraphrasing here, so it may not be precisely, but it's a great safety for the president and the country and a great comfort to them for the president to know he is not a great man.
Calvin Coolidge's death came just weeks ahead of the inauguration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, whose New Deal presidency would usher in an era of massive federal expansion. So in hindsight, Coolidge said something at the end of his life that seems really appropriate. He told a friend, quote, "I feel I no longer fit in with these times," end quote. He didn't. And now in the century since Coolidge's passing, it seems like any defender of the Constitution wouldn't fit in with any time since his. Coolidge may not have considered himself a great man, but as we reflect on his incredible career, perhaps he would excuse us if we were to judge him so.
Glenn Beck.
Unbelievable.
He's got no choice because I think he was a great man.
Absolutely.
Yeah. A great man. That story where he goes to Rushmore and sees it being sculpted in
and
especially,
is grossed out.
Especially the giant image of Theodore Roosevelt, who he didn't like his policies. He didn't like the way he
ended up. He's a progressive.
Yeah. And it just turned him off. And he's like, that's not what we're supposed to be about.
And that's not who I want to be. And what I love about it is the ending where he's saying, you become blind to the truth that you're not a great man. You're surrounded by people who are yes men. Boy, that kind of humility is really scarce.
Sure is. George Washington, Calvin Coolidge. I think those
Abraham
are the,
Lincoln.
Maybe
I think
Lincoln
too.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe.
No, I think Abraham Lincoln, if you can even call it this, his only arrogance came from a true belief that he was a man of destiny not a man in destiny of get out of my way, a man of, oh, crap, I don't want to do this. I mean, I really believe he was truly humble and only did what he felt he was really supposed to
do.
The
difference between the two, though, is Coolidge strictly adhered to the Constitution.
Yes.
Lincoln
yes.
did not.
Yes. He was... So. Coolidge is... I am a new fan of Coolidge.
Oh, man.
He is definitely top three. He might be two. He might be number two as far as presidents.
Glenn Beck program.
Hello, America. So the alt-right is going absolutely nuts about the strike against Syria. And the reason why is because he was really sold, and he sold himself as an anti-war president and a guy who's not going to be involved. And he spoke over and over and over again about not getting involved in Syria. Let Russia take care of this, correct? He made a big deal out of you've got to go to Congress. Barack Obama's got to go to Congress before he does anything in Syria. Well, that's not what he did. Now, the people on the alt-right and the big anti-war people who believed Donald Trump was that kind of guy now are very upset. This is going to cause problems in the White House. I'll explain it to you. Next.